Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema. Who were these guys?
It's time to get this show on the road. It's Junk Food Cinema, brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com. Dot guzzling. I'm your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host. He's a novelist, he's a screenwriter, he is definitely a warlord of the 21st century, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
How's it going?
It is raucous. It is rowdy.
It is all of those things. And it's interesting that we are talking about this movie instead of any of the innumerable movies that ripped it off that we've probably covered before
talking about this movie. We've covered so many. Well, kind of. Because that's the thing is, you know, a movie that most people would argue that something like Battle Truck ripped off The Road Warrior.
I'm sorry, did you just say Battle Truck?
Battle Truck. But instead, Battle Truck was made before The Road Warrior. It was ripping off Mad Max and going to the next evolution that everyone was going to. It was part of the post-apocalyptic revolution. But most people, you know, but after that, once we get to the mid-80s, everything is fucking ripping off The Road Warrior, including a TV show we talked about previously, a thing called...
The Highwaymen.
Battle Truck.
But no, we are, of course, talking about the single. Last week, we talked about one of the greatest, arguably the greatest Western of all time. Today, we are talking about inarguably the greatest exploitation film of all time. A film so good, a lot of people...
It just has to be fattening. Oh, wait, no, that's our show. Sorry.
That's our show. A movie so good, people would probably go... But are we calling it exploitation? Is it really? Yes, it is.
It absolutely is.
It's just, it is something that transcends where a lot of exploitation was held back by its budget. This is a movie that had a genius at the helm making what is arguably his best film. Like, George Miller's made a number of other great films. There are two perfect films in this four-film series, and he's made a number of good films. He's made films that I have issues with, and we could go on at length of Miller as a director overall, but this film is inarguably a masterpiece. It is just so fucking good, so fucking lean, and is George Miller's... you know, attempt at making his own version of Once Upon a Time in the West. This is Once Upon a Time in the Post-Apocalyptic Future.
Once Upon a Time on Wheels. And speaking of absolute genius and lean, well, I don't know about lean.
Oh, I didn't know we were plugging my books this week.
Hey, that's a good one, Pelly. You can find our...
My new book, Family of Cops.
I want you to write a fantasy book called Family of Orcs. And they all have mustaches.
They're all Polish. They're Polish orcs with mustaches.
And one of them thinks he's Mexican for some reason. It's really kind of embarrassing, but we keep him around anyway. No, I was talking about this podcast, whose entire back catalog is on iTunes. It's also on Blog Talk Radio. It's also on Spotify. There's so many ways for you to put us in your ear holes. So go do that. You can also follow us on Twitter at
Junk Food
Cinema.
You don't need to put me in any of your holes.
Put them in all the holes. At Junk Food Cinema on Twitter.
You just broke yourself.
I immediately regret saying that.
I love it. That's how I want Meryl to get... to just clip that so we can just drop that in every once in a while.
Oh, good.
Because I don't know you're going to be able to hit that note just as perfect as you hit right there.
Oh, good. That's a drop now.
Put it in all your holes.
Facebook.com.
.com.
/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like the show.
I mean, you really like putting it in all your holes.
You can go to Patreon. I'm waiting.
.com.
/junkfoodcinema for as little as a dollar an episode. You get access to bonus content no one else gets to hear that can go in any hole you like. We're gonna no judgment. It's up to you.
I'm definitely judging certain holes. Like, there's just certain earbuds I'm not gonna borrow after that.
Okay, can we sidebar? Can we talk about how you shouldn't borrow anyone's earbuds ever? Like, that's, to me, that's like if you went to your doctor and they used the same like ear, what do they call it, the ear scope, but they didn't change the little tip on the end. Like, that's just fucking weird. Don't share earbuds. Like, I don't know. I'm weird. I'm not weird about a lot of germy things, but people who share earbuds, just, it freaks me the fuck out. I don't know why. It bothers me a little bit. So I'll just be over here on this island by myself.
While we're at the sidebar, can we talk about the fact that why does no karaoke joint I've ever been to have Cool Modee at all?
Yeah, what is that about?
Well, why? I mean, no Wild Wild West.
Wild Wild West.
Yeah, I go to work.
Yeah, you want to do Wild Wild West. I desperately want to do I Go to Work. I fucking love that song.
So do I. Every karaoke joint, it's become my thing. It is every karaoke joint I go to, I'm just like, I just kind of like look both ways and open up. Do you have a Cool Modee? No Cool Modee section. It's like Cool Modee never existed, not even for the Koreans, and they like the B-sides of everything.
Holy shit. So I went to a Korean karaoke place here in town, and in their book, there were 3 songs by Johnny Cash and 12 songs by Sixpence None the Richer.
Yes.
I didn't know Sixpence None the Richer had 12 songs. I thought they had 6 songs, none the more.
That's twice the number of Sixpences. Like, that is a hell of a lot of None the Richer.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's the weird, that's if you've never been to a Korean joint, karaoke joint, because a lot of places you have to buy the music and you get certain things for significantly cheaper. So it's like, well, we've got to have some Johnny Cash in here, but for 50 cents more, we can get 12 Sixpence None the Richer songs.
Sixpence more the cheaper, as it turns out.
And so you end up with these books that are filled with entire catalogs of bands that were one-hit wonders. And it's kind of the most amazing thing
ever.
They
are literally cheaper by the dozen. That's why they have exactly 12 songs by Sixpence None the Richer.
Kiss me.
Stop saying that to me. I am really happy that we're covering, finally, on Junk Food Cinema, The Road Warrior.
In the future, cities will become deserts. Roads will become battlefields. And the hope of mankind will appear as a stranger. Pray that he's out there somewhere.
Or, depending on where you're from, Mad Max 2.
Or depending on which version you have downloaded, because I bought The Road Warrior off Amazon. And then when I sat down to watch it again last night, and I've watched this having bought it, I've watched it easily a dozen times. I know that I watched it half a dozen times while making Doctor Strange. This is a 45-minute drive to set and back home again. And so every day I had an hour and a half, and it's a 95-minute movie with credits. So I could, in one day, watch The Road Warrior to and from work. So I did it a lot. So I've seen.
Why the hell wouldn't you?
But so it went from being The Road Warrior to, when I watched it last night, now it's Mad Max 2. And I kind of dug that. But my version is Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior. But it looked like they had pasted that on to the beginning for some reason, that now that my streaming version has that. I don't know what the fuck, but there it is. Now I've got Mad Max 2.
So if you're ever wondering whether The Road Warrior qualifies as Ozploitation, let's talk about that title for a second, because we've got some real Italian Dawn of the Dead shit going on here.
Yes, we do.
In that Mad Max 1979 was an enormous fucking smash hit in Australia. Huge, huge fucking hit. When it came to the States, it didn't have the same type of reception. It did well, but it just didn't connect with audiences here the same as it did in its home country.
Well, the weird thing is that in Mad Max, when you're from Australia, you see that it's supposed to be a post-apocalyptic film. It looks like a post-apocalyptic film. You recognize things of Australia and see what's not normal. To Americans, it just looked like Australia. So the first time people watched Mad Max, they didn't know it was supposed to be a dystopian future.
Right. Yeah.
It was just a movie about a police officer in another country who gets hassled by a gang.
Look at the original poster for Mad Max and ask yourself where that character is in that movie, because he's not there. He is, in fact, all over the place in The Road Warrior. I actually just noticed that on this viewing, that half of the cronies of Lord Humongous are dressed like the guy from the original poster with the police helmet and the weird, like, face jockstrap. Yeah, like, that doesn't really exist in the first movie, but those guys are all over the fucking place in Road Warrior. But when they went to make a sequel, it was the most expensive production in the history of Australian cinema, which was a fairly young industry. So, yes, it was the most expensive movie, but that doesn't mean that it was, like, that they had all the money in the world to work with.
Quite the opposite.
But, I mean, George Miller is a fucking genius. He had an amazing stunt crew, an amazing cinematographer. Those guys put together something that had really not been seen before. And I'm not just talking in terms of the stunt work, but I mean the look of it, the grittiness of, like, everything that really defines post-apocalyptic from that point forward in cinema comes a lot from The Road Warrior. But they were going to release it as Mad Max 2. And they were worried that American audiences hadn't seen the first one, so they convinced Miller to release it in the States as The Road Warrior, so there was no onus upon the audience to have seen the first movie. And I actually, I have a theory that that's why so much of the first 5 minutes of this movie is a history of how the world fell apart, and then peppered in last week on Mad Max.
Yeah.
On Mad Max.
Last week on Mad Max.
Yes.
Mad Max's family was brutally murdered, and he killed a bunch of people in horrible, awful ways, and now he is wandering with a dog.
And accidentally kicked off the Saw franchise, and everyone is caught up. Okay, great.
By the way, for those of you that don't know, it has been openly admitted by Lee Whannell and James Wan that they ripped off the ending of Saw from the ending of Mad Max. Like, that is, they were like, what if the guy actually sawed his foot off? Like, that is exactly what they fucking did.
I can't wait in Aquaman for Aquaman to run over Black Manta in a semi-truck. That's going to be fucking rad. I can't wait for that to happen. I'm assuming that's what's going to happen.
So let's talk about Miller for a second and something that Miller does, and he did here, but he does exceptionally well in the brilliant follow-up Fury Road. So George Miller is going to go down in history as the Kubrick of action films. Like, he is just the Kubrick. And where Kubrick pioneered center point cinematography, where it's like, I'm going to place this thing in the center and everything is going to, it's like going to be this beautiful, gorgeous, like shooting down a hallway, and has been really ripped off. But really when you see a shot from a Kubrick film, you're like, oh yeah, this is Kubrick. What Miller did is he pioneered center point action. And what he does is he puts crosshairs over his monitor so that whenever they're shooting action, the action happens right in the center of the fucking frame. When somebody gets hit, when somebody hits the ground, when somebody gets shot, when a car is hitting something, it is always in the center so that when he cuts, and he cuts a lot, he loves fast editing. His editing has gotten faster and faster over the years. You always know what's going on. There's a reason why when you watch Mad Max Fury Road and all that batshit stuff is happening and people are getting hit and fighting left and right, you never go, oh, you know, it's just too fast. Just cut, 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 cut. It doesn't look like they're really fighting. It really does. Even though they're cutting as fast as every other, you know, Paul Greengrass-like director out there, the difference is your eyes don't have to move from the center of the frame, so you're always able to process the image you're looking at. And he is slavish to it. There's great video of him like yelling at the cinematographer in the fucking center, in this, you're off center, because he knows that he's going to cut four different shots into a 2 second section, but you're going to walk away having seen all of it and processing all of it. And you're going to feel like that was a really hard hit in an action film. And it's brilliant how he does it and the way he does it. And by pioneering that, everybody else just kind of smacked their forehead and said, oh, that's how you do fast cut action. That makes so much fucking sense. Why didn't we think of that? But he figured it out, cracked the code, and that's why his films, as fast-paced as they are so cinematic, and you're never confused of the geography of his action sequences.
Well, and he had a crew that was completely unconcerned with their own safety. I mean, I don't know how else to put it.
Well, in Road Warrior, yes.
In Road Warrior. I mean, this was a crew that, I mean, no matter how they tried to meticulously set up and plan for every stunt, inevitably there were accidents. But what's incredible about the Road Warrior is that the accidents that happened behind the scenes, and look at any featurette and you'll find this information, the worst accidents that happened behind the scenes end up in the final cut of this movie. Of course, the most recognizable is the stunt where the guy goes flipping end over end after his car runs into something that was not supposed to happen.
No.
And now he is the stunt, and something has gone terribly wrong.
And when you see that in real time, it is fucking terrifying. You're like, I'm witnessing faces of death. Like, that's what I'm watching right now. That guy, surely dead. Thank God, not what happened at all. But then you see, like, immediately they'll go to another stunt, and oh, that went poorly as well, the shot is so good that we will leave it in there, and that guy will go on to be the stunt coordinator for Fury Road. Like, this is a crew dedicated to their craft in a way few people are. Like, stuntmen in general, this is true of, but I mean, the guys that worked on the fucking Road Warrior.
Speaking of which.
Let's do.
Next week, we're talking about Hooper, the story of stuntmen.
Yes.
And
that should be the full title. Yeah. Hooper, colon, a story of stuntmen.
I mean, it's
colon, the Road Warrior.
It's what it fucking is. Yeah, like, yeah. And we'll get into that. Next week, we're going to be talking about these types of dudes in Hal Needham's love letter to his profession. These guys go above and fucking beyond.
And in a way that they are making it work on a budget. Like, there was a great featurette where they showed that stunt of the guy flipping. And he lands on not an airbag, but several empty cardboard boxes that have been propped up as a makeshift airbag. I mean, yes, most expensive production, asterisk, in Australian film history.
Yeah.
Not talking about all the money in the world here. Guy's landing on cardboard fucking boxes. Like he's your cousin doing backyard wrestling. What the fuck? And they make it look so good. Like, the real brilliance of this movie is understanding that there are limits to what you can do in car stunts in movies, and then going, no, we're going to fucking do this anyway, and have a chase that lasts for 15 straight minutes that is one of the greatest action sequences in any movie ever.
Well, and this is one of the other things that fascinates me about Miller. A lot of times, particularly in these movies, Miller isn't operating from a script.
Right.
Miller is operating from storyboards that he's using as a script. Now, it is important to note that Miller writes these movies as meticulously as any screenwriter, but he's doing it with the images as opposed to words. So when you say that, you know, a movie like Fury Road was written without a script, it's like, yeah, that's kind of true. But it's not actually true, because his storyboards are his scripts, and he has shot for shot drawn out, this is what this is going to look like. And he has figured it out and worked it out well in advance so that he knows this is going to look fucking gorgeous, and it's going to be gorgeous. And yeah, you've got these, you open with a 4.5 minute monologue where it's like, you know, the two great tribes went to war for some reason over the guzzoline.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the, you know,
The precious juice.
We talk about the oil wars and Mad Max for 4.5 minutes. And then all of a sudden, bam, that's all the exposition you get, because now Mad Max is on the run from a couple of fuckheads. And it's going to be an ugly, brutal fight. And that's the movie you're in. Enjoy a car chase for a while, because fuck yeah, car chase.
And I do love and appreciate that all the bad guys in this movie look like they're on their way to an Iron Maiden concert that they're way too into.
Or were adapted as WWF wrestlers later in the 80s. Like, this is a movie so influential. There were two wrestlers who literally wrestled as the Road Warriors who were just dressed up as dudes from this movie.
And if you don't remember the Road Warriors, all I can say is that I am gravely disappointed because they were awesome.
The Road Warriors were fucking awesome. The thing that's so great about Miller's post-apocalyptic future is he does a thing that a lot of people don't do. And it's something that I learned from him and something that I, because The Road Warrior was a big influence for me on my book Sea of Rust. And this was one of the movies that I really, when I was watching it over and over again, I was processing Sea of Rust. And one of the lessons I took from this movie was, don't be afraid to be weird. Like, the thing about this movie that works is while everything is taken seriously, the movie has some batshit crazy stuff that ordinarily you might write off, but because of the nature of the movie, you're like, no, I get it. So when they're introducing the leader of this tribe and go,
the Ayatollah of rock and roller,
you're just fucking in. Like, you're in. You buy it. You're not like, this is fucking stupid.
Which, by the way, speaking of the WWE, wrestler Chris Jericho used to introduce himself as
the Ayatollah of Rock and Roller.
You genuflect when you say that name, motherfucker. Chris Jericho's the fucking man.
He will break the walls of Jericho down. Don't you worry about it. Let's go back just for a second, because we keep referring to The Road Warrior as a post-apocalyptic masterpiece, which is exactly what it is. It should be noted that a lot of people refer to Mad Max as a post-apocalyptic movie. It is actually a rare situation in which the apocalypse is upon the characters in the movie, but it hasn't fully happened yet in Mad Max. We're waiting on the cusp of the downfall of society that has started to happen, but I guess nobody bothered to really tell Australia because... So, I mean, much like we were talking about with the way American audiences reacted to it, a lot of it just felt like the Australian outback. It didn't feel like the rest of the world had completely fallen apart yet. And I feel like that was by design. Mad Max is a story about a guy about to lose his humanity. The Road Warrior is about the rest of the world losing their humanity and him regaining it, which is what's so fucking fascinating as a story arc between those two movies. And that's one of my favorite things about The Road Warrior, is that it is fully post-apocalyptic, whereas Mad Max is apocalyptic, I guess.
It's dystopian.
Yes,
very it's dystopian. It's right on the edge of the apocalypse, and it's about to everything's about to break down. This is where everything's broken down, and it is dark, and everything is fucked, and it also created an entire like. Let's talk about the bad for a second. Road Warrior did a lot of damage to Australian cinema because once Road Warrior came out, virtually every Australian film had to have outback bullies.
Oh my God.
And it became a thing. Bullies. And sometimes it's good. Sometimes it's used very effectively. And sometimes it's just, no, this is just the nature of Ausploitation now, because it became the thing where you had to have bully rapists in the outback truly terrorizing people because it was a truly scary thing. There is a sequence in this fucking movie that, I mean, it's really one of those things that it's one of those things that goes to the back of your mind. So when you think of Road Warrior, you think of the car chases, and you think of all the cars driving around the fortress out in the middle of the valley. You kind of forget the brutal murder and rape of a woman in the middle of the road.
Yeah.
And then it gets there and it hits you in the gut every fucking time where it's like, oh, fuck, right. Shit, no, they really, like, he's looking through the binoculars and seeing her just get stripped and about to get raped and murdered. And it's harsh. And yeah. That became a hallmark of Australian cinema, which is part of, and the reason I talk about it in the bad context is it's part of what made Australian cinema, Ausploitation, feel seedy in the 80s. And sometimes it's used to, like I said, to great effect, like in one of our favorites, Razorback.
Razorback. By the way, shot by Dean Semler, who also shot the Road Warrior.
Yes, which, you know, that's another piece de resistance of Ozploitation. But then you would find a number of other Ozploitation films that would just kind of abuse it, and you'd just be kind of like, oh, here's the 5 minutes we're going to spend with a guy with spiky hair threatening to rape a woman.
I feel like that's the worst example of that, in a pretty decent movie, but definitely the worst example of that is in the movie Fair Game, where the woman runs the wildlife refuge and literally gets stripped naked and strapped to the front of a car that they just drive around, and it's like... She's a fucking hood ornament. What is going on right now?
It's a fucked up scene, but it really kind of put a stamp on Australian cinema in a way that I don't think is fully processed, and is part of the reason I think Ozploitation ended. I think in some weird way, Road Warrior did so many things so well that were then aped that it caused the self-destruction of that environment. And that's just my personal opinion on it, because it became a thing after that, like, you know, the outlaw bullies in the Outback.
But would you say it caused the destruction of Jared Sin? Because that's the important question.
No.
What led to the destruction of Jared Sin?
The fact that Metal Storm is that Space Hunter is better than Metal Storm.
We're going to have that
episode. Or 3D cinema. We have to have that episode.
We're going to hash that out.
There were 19 3D films in 1983, and according to our friends over at 80s All Over, none of them are good. I disagree on a few points.
Enter this show.
We're point of order, Drew and Scott.
From the kids' table, we say, a harumph.
A harumph to you. I can think of at least two 3D films in 1983 that I think are fantastic.
By the way, do you know the connection between the Road Warrior and the destruction of Jared Sin?
No.
That Jared Sin is in the fucking Road Warrior?
Oh, shit.
He plays, is it Papagallo? The leader of, like, the little resistance within the fort that has the oil well? That's fucking Jared Sin!
Oh, Jesus, that's gonna change things for me. By the way, here's one of the things I adore about this fucking movie. This movie is a fucking Western. Like, it is a Western through and through. And it is, again, as we've talked about last week and this week, it is George Miller's version of Once Upon a Time in the West, in which it is told through cinematography and action and not so much in dialogue.
Yeah.
There aren't scenes of people sitting and discussing things. Max has 16 lines of dialogue in the whole fucking movie.
May I do a dramatic reading of the first piece of dialogue in this movie?
Let's do it.
That was it.
And scene.
And scene. That's it. That's
we
the first
end
piece
up,
of dialogue.
This is such a great example of the story trope of a man comes to town. Mm-hmm. Where it's this guy feels bad for this dude who's been, you know, mortally wounded. His girlfriend slash wife has been brutally raped and murdered. He's been left for dead. He goes and talks to him. He's like, oh, we've got gasoline. I'll take you to it. And I'll make you a deal. If you get me home, I'll get you all the gasoline you want. And the guy, and Max is like, all right, I can do that. I need gasoline. That's why I'm here. So he goes and takes him back, and he carts him all the way back, and the guy dies right there. And then the guys who are in the place are like, fuck you. We don't trust you. You're an outsider. We're chaining you up. We're the bad guys now. So this group who is supposed to be, you know, the trod upon, you know, good guys, mm-hmm, are really the fucking assholes at this point. And now Max is caught between two tribes of pretty kind of selfish, awful people, who are both fighting in their own way for their own survival. And he's put in a situation where, shit, I need to help these people, not because I need to help them, but because it's the only way I'm going to get my car back. It's the only way me and my dog are getting out of here.
Right.
And so he has to go on this mission, which leads to one of the most amazing chases in the history of, you know. So, you know, it's odd. When I hear people talk about the greatest car chases ever, I don't ever hear them mention the Road Warriors.
How?
We talk about Bullet.
How do you have that conversation without the movie coming up?
We talk about Bad Boys 2. We don't talk about the Road Warrior. And really, the road that final chase is really probably one of the greatest. It is one of the greatest action scenes of all time. It is one of the greatest car chases of all time. I remember there was a screening of The Road Warrior here for a film festival, and I can't
South by Southwest.
Was it South by?
Because actually, over on 80s All Over, Drew McWinney talks about he hosted that screening.
Right.
Because it was right before Fury Road came out.
Yes. And the story of that everybody here in town has heard about is Robert Rodriguez attended that screening. So Robert's a huge fan of the movie. Robert shows up to a lot of stuff locally. Good dude. And he raised his hand first and stood up and said, yeah, George, I just have one question. How did you do it? Because Robert Rodriguez was floored watching that film and just the entire time watching it as a filmmaker going, how would I make this? And could not figure it out. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you make The Road Warrior? How do you make that work? How did you do that? And it really is a film to marvel at because it's a film that's so much a part of our film canon. You have to be a teenager or older in 1982 to really, is it 81 or 82?
This was 1982. It was part 82. Of that amazing summer.
Yeah. To have really remembered a world before this was what the post-apocalypse looked like. Because everything in the 80s then ripped this off. And we had so many, I mean, this entire podcast exists because of those kind of knockoffs. You know, just the After the Fall of New York's and the
Exterminators of the Year 3000.
Yes, and even shit like Solar Babies.
Or Seal Dawn.
Yes, you know, films that...
Oh, we could do this all fucking day.
We
don't
can.
Test us.
We've seen them all. In fact, no, there's one post-apocalyptic film I've never seen, and I'm terrified to watch it.
What's that?
America 3000.
Oh, yeah. That's actually one I haven't seen either.
Because it's a post-apocalyptic comedy, and that just never set. Like, I've watched some crazy fucking shit. Like, I have... I've watched some really, really, really bad plastic Uzi bearing post-apocalyptic movies.
Sure, sure.
But America 3000 is the one. I have it on DVD. It came with a four set that when I bought Eliminators on DVD, because you could not buy Eliminators on its own at the time. It had to be with a four pack of movies like Arena and America 3000.
Yeah, you can take this girl out on a date, but her little brother's coming too. Mm-hmm. Is essentially what that situation.
Yeah, and you're buying dinner for the whole family.
Of course.
I
mean, they're not supposed to be funny. They're not intentionally, but like Hell Comes to Frogtown, hilarious, not on purpose, not on purpose.
I don't know. Roddy Piper post-apocalyptic movie kind of was meant to be funny. It was always a cult film. I
well, then it should have been funnier.
You know what? I need to revisit that because maybe we need to do an episode on Hell Comes to Frogtown because just, and we can do it as a double feature if we want with Terror of Tiny Town.
Dude, that is just going to be 60 minutes of the two of us telling each other to shut your hole, which is the best line in that fucking movie that a frog man says to Roddy.
Shut your hole. This movie does so much with so little.
Yeah, and that's what's crazy. And I want to talk about this again. Not only the stunt people, but the cinematographer on this movie was just as fearless. I mean, he would put cameras inside of cages and race them right alongside the action. And there's one shot, actually, where a car goes sideways and comes careening toward the camera, and they cut just before impact, but that car hit that fucking camera. So it's not as if... Similar himself was removed from all the danger. Like, he's fucking right in the trenches. In the trailer, they say something to the effect of highways become battlegrounds. And I feel like that is apt to describe the production of this movie because so many people got hurt. There were like literally back-to-back injuries that ended the involvement of two people in this movie just because they were like, I'm literally too hurt to continue. I'm sorry.
And now he is the stunt and something has gone terribly wrong.
So it's just... ballsy. This entire movie is so fucking ballsy, and I feel like it's an Orson Welles situation, where everyone talks about Orson Welles breaking all the rules, but Orson Welles answers that by saying, I didn't know what the rules were, so I wasn't trying to break them, I literally just had no concept of what they were. And I feel like George Miller doesn't, like, he doesn't care what the rules are, he knows how he wants it to look, and he's going to make that happen by hook or by crook. I don't feel like he was setting out to break the rules of cinema. I feel like he's, you know, on a continent where it's like, we don't really have those rules.
All right, Cargill, we're here.
Yes.
Oh, God damn it, Future Brian, is that you again? You know it. This, however, does not look like the Circle K. Cargill, back in the machine. We're going to try again.
Well, shit.
For the love of God, stop using the time cop machine.
We have the technology to be able to do that.
Put it back in the basement. Well, that was weird. I'm sorry. What were you saying?
So here's the thing is we have a reverence of Hal Needham on the show.
Yep.
And you will fully understand that next week. Next week, we are going to have a very deep conversation about the nature of Hal Needham, who Hal Needham was, and why we have a love for films that many of you even shrug off and go, I don't get why Cargill, I like Megaforce is fun, but why does Cargill wear the fact that he's a lieutenant of Megaforce on his sleeve like that? We're going to get into that next week. This is... What's interesting is Hal Needham was one of the greatest stuntmen in history. He was one of the greatest stunt minds in history. George Miller is the great stuntman director who makes stuntman movies that are better than the best stuntman's movies. Like, the thing about Hal Needham is he was a stuntman making movies with stuntmen, for audiences who enjoyed stunts. George Miller was the Kubrick of that oeuvre. Like, he really did. It really does. I mean, he's still making movies. He's still working on something else. I keep hearing that there's not going to be another Fury Road, which pisses me off. But I'm like, fine. We have two perfect films in a four-film series with one good film, two perfect films, and one film that we can sit and debate on but really isn't all that.
We don't need another discussion about that.
Yeah. Yeah,
we don't need to find its way home.
Who run Bartertown?
Run Bartertown. We are Master Blaster. You break the deal, you face the wheel. Look.
Yeah.
The thing is. Quick sidebar.
Sidebar.
That movie, as ridiculous as it is, has some of the most iconic touchstones of the franchise.
Because
when people think of Mad Max, they think of Thunderdome. Thunderdome gets referenced more than most shit in any of the other movies, but it's in the worst movie.
It's in the worst movie because it's the one movie with dialogue. Which is why it's the worst movie. Like,
mystery presented, mystery solved.
There's too many people standing around talking. You know what you don't need in a fucking Mad Max movie? Any fucking talking. Like, you need enough dialogue to explain what the fuck is going on. Then you get on the road and you chase each other. It's a fucking Mad Max movie.
This is not Bantertown. We don't need someone to run Bantertown.
That's right. You know, there's really no reason. Like, there's some great fucking character actors in that movie, but there's a little too much talking in that movie. Like, I know, let's take a guy who people love watching race around in cars and let's put him in a cage. Yeah. That's a great idea. No, that's not a great idea.
But it is also the only movie that has a soundtrack song. So it's like, of course people are going to remember We Don't Need Another Hero, because literally,
we don't need another Mad Max.
Do-do-do. Because first of all, that song is fucking amazing. And
yes,
secondly, there's nothing, there's within the context of this franchise, it is in competition with no one.
By the way, sidebar to a sidebar, if...
Sideception.
If you are in London, if you are near London at any time soon, there is a movie, there is a stage show right now called Tina. That is,
oh wow,
fucking amazing. It stars this amazing woman who plays Tina Turner. So fucking good. A guy I worked with on Doctor Strange, Cobna Holbrook-Smith, he plays Ike Turner and is fucking amazing.
So is it like one of those, like a jukebox musical biography type of thing?
Yes.
Cool.
But the genius of it is that it gets to the end of the play and then it turns and changes the audience from watching a play to the audience being the audience at a Tina Turner concert for 15 minutes. And this amazing, so it's this really, really good, really fucking brilliantly designed play about the life of Tina Turner, complete with crazy batshit Phil Spector sequence that is just really great.
Phil got to do with it? Got to do with it.
And then the ending is so well orchestrated and put together that everyone goes out fucking singing the songs. And it is, so if you're anywhere nearby and you're a Tina Turner fan at all, holy shit, Tina is like the real deal. We saw it when we were last in London. It was fucking great.
That sounds pretty rad.
Yeah. So, okay, Back to Road Warriors.
Stargrove.
Stargrove. Stargrove.
Just to point out how fucking dangerous this set was. So when the tanker truck rolls at the end of the movie, that was deemed too dangerous for any driver to actually drive the tanker. Someone still did, but was asked not to eat anything for 12 hours because he was probably going to have to be rushed into surgery immediately after the stunt. Like, that's the level of no fucks to give these stuntmen. Like, we are going to get this fucking shot and we don't care about anything else. And I think part of the reason for that is that George Miller was trained as a doctor. Like, he was literally a medic before he was a director. So he's on set, like, not only as the guy running the show, but if something goes wrong, he's the first guy in the fucking trenches to help out, which is good because a lot of things went wrong on this set. But here is my definitive, this is the greatness of Mad Max. This is the greatness of that final chase. I'm going to tell you guys something that I promise you none of you have ever noticed before. In the span of that 14 to 15 minutes of that final chase, the sky goes from crystal clear to cloudy to sunset, back to midday, sunny again, cloudy again, rainy. None of you ever noticed that. I promise you none of you have ever noticed the fact that they clearly shot it over several different days and didn't give a fuck about that continuity.
That is very much what Martin Scorsese argues, and that Christopher Nolan proved in The Dark Knight. There is a great 20-minute YouTube documentary that will show you the power of editing. It is designed to show you why Christopher Nolan is a terrible director. I feel that, first of all, it shows that Christopher Nolan doesn't give a shit about continuity, and it proves that without a doubt, but it also proves the power of editing and where the audience is and focusing on telling the audience a story. The chase in The Dark Knight, the big semi-chase, is a continuity nightmare. The number of cop cars change, the side of the road, the side of the concrete barrier that the fucking semi is driving on changes. There's a bit where they're driving across a bridge. They're underground across a bridge, and a car comes from a cross street to run into the semi, and you have never noticed any of it. The same way here. When you focus on the action, when you focus on the bam, 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 when you focus on that center point, nobody cares what's going on in the rest of the frame. We're watching everything else. We are watching the action. We are ignoring the other things. As Martin Scorsese argues, if you're watching a movie so many times, you start recognizing when the type of cigarettes that the actor is smoking changes, then I've fucked up as a filmmaker. Yeah. Then you aren't paying attention. You have either A, watched this movie too many times, or B, I didn't make this scene interesting enough that you're paying attention to the fucking cigarette packet. Or, you know, there's the C that he doesn't mention, which is, or you're fucking autistic, chill the fucking out, stop staring at other things on the movie and watch the fucking movie.
Although to be fair, you go too far with that and you get the Ed Wood problem. Like, Ed, those tombstones just fell over. No one's going to notice that. But that, again,
absolutely.
If he had made a better movie, maybe they wouldn't.
If you're a genius who knows how to tell a story and is focused on the action over here, no, nobody's going to care about over here. Ed Wood was not a genius.
Turns out.
So you're absolutely right. You continuity, this is why it's an argument. It's why there is actually a professional job that your whole job of script supervisor is tracking fucking continuity and making sure that everything in the script as written happens, and then keeping track of what hand somebody used to pick something up in three shots. And oh, in this fourth and fifth shot, she's using her left hand and not her right hand. So we need to note that.
I think of that job as keeper of the Polaroids, because I can't remember what set it was, but I remember someone doing that job and taking a shit ton of Polaroid pictures.
There are people that do that. That is not the script supervisor itself, but somebody who is an adjunct to that person, usually an assistant. The script supervisor, by the way, weird Hollywood insider thing, almost entirely women. It is rare when you find a male script supervisor, and they're referred to in the industry as unicorns. Another aside, one of our longtime friends and Twitter trolls, Nick Robinson.
Nick Rob.
Nick Rob is a script, is a male script supervisor. We know a unicorn, and it's the oddest thing. But it is one of
Nick Robb's a unicorn for a lot of reasons.
Yes. If you don't follow Nick Robb on Twitter, you are missing out on one of the great irony Twitter accounts of all time. Also, a absurd fascination with L.A. car chases.
Yes. Like, not the kind in this movie.
No. Like actual police chases. Like I swear to God, he and Jen Yamato have to have a police scanner in their apartment just for that.
Guys, that's a podcast. I'm just going to throw it out there. That's a fucking podcast that I would listen to day in and day out.
Nick Robinson and Jen Yamato talking about LA
while
car
listening
chases.
To an actual police scanner. Fuck yes, absolutely.
I'm convinced that's what's happening.
Make it happen.
But Stargrove.
Stargrove?
Stargrove.
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 That's not a Stargrove. That's a Stargrove. All right, I promise. Okay, fuck it. Sidebar one more time.
Sidebar. Let's do it.
The best part about revisiting this now for me is that the Australian that like permeates my entire life right now are the fucking Wiggles. Because that's
that's right. You have kids.
Yeah, my 18-month-old loves the fucking Wiggles, watches it nonstop, and they are super duper Australian.
Can I share with you a bit of Wiggles trivia you might not know?
Oh, let's do it. Yeah.
During the height of Wiggles mania, when they were huge, mm-hmm. the Wiggles traveled on two yep. separate planes.
They were never allowed to travel. They were that important to their country's culture that they were worried that if something happened to the plane and they lost all four Wiggles, they would be too much of a national tragedy. So they flew separate like they were the goddamn Beatles.
Because there would always be two Wiggles to carry on.
Which is fucked up in and of itself.
On my Wiggles, son.
Gee, come on, let's
get it.
They'll
be sad when you get done. Lay your children's head to rest.
Oh my God, I hate the Wiggles. There's nothing wrong with
you
them.
You really do. Look, like, you guys don't know how much off mic time we've spent discussing the Wiggles.
I understand that they are not bad people.
No.
I get that. However, I want them to stop immediately because if I have to listen to any more of the Rockabye Bay and Gee, Come On Guys and all that other shit, like it's going to drive me
every
insane.
Time I see them, all I see is like red shirts from a Star Trek knockoff.
But you know what? It never ends the way you want it to. Let me just put it that way.
They never beam down to the planet and don't come back. Kirk, what happened to the Wiggles? There was a magma monster.
All I know is that they're not allowed to travel together. Stargrove.
I want to watch that Star Trek episode now. I want to see the Wiggles beam down to the planet and have somebody upset that they're not supposed to beam down together.
They have a real weird thing about the phones on that show. Like, they never know when the phone is ringing. They never know whose phone is ringing. It takes them 20 minutes to answer a goddamn phone. It's super weird. If you watch enough of it, what's the deal with the phones? Anyway, fucking Stargrove.
Stargrove!
But you would think there'd be plenty for us to talk about in the Road Warrior that we wouldn't have to diverge into a...
Why wouldn't we diverge
it's
into...
It's what we do.
What, do you think people listen to this to hear about the movies? I think they learned their lesson a long time ago.
I mean, there's a part of me that still hopes that, but I guess I can't argue with you.
I mean, the movie's just the framework for the Stargroves.
Yes.
I mean, that
Road Warrior was just a red herring. But one thing I do...
Communism's just a red herring.
I do want to... Also, I imagine that there is a film course at Oral Roberts or Liberty University that uses this movie to explain what would happen. It's like all of the people inside the compound protecting the oil are good capitalists, and then socialists live outside with all their leather daddy shit, and they want to steal the oil and give it to everyone. I feel like this is the exemplar movie that there's a film course at one of those two colleges.
I love how passe you were about calling it leather daddy, like you were Scott Wampler or something.
All these rubber bands! We're inside the baseball, guys.
Yeah.
Whenever we mention other like film critics or other like
keep in mind
pundits,
that half of our followers follow film Twitter.
This
so,
is true.
So they're like, people are going, I understood that reference.
Yes, go ask film Twitter is going to be the new ask your parents.
Go ask film Twitter.
Gee, come on. One thing I do want to say about the character of Max, you've mentioned him as sort of the Sergio Leone man with no name, which is apt because literally at one point in this movie, They refer to him as the Road Warrior, and the narrator says, "I knew him as Max," suggesting that no one else knew his fucking name,
yeah.
which is interesting. I had a different take on this watching him this time. I think that Max is Han Solo. He is a guy who is stuck between two sides in a war. He is a scavenger, a rascal, someone living on the fringe, does not want to get involved, trying to protect his own interests, and actually, through the conflict, finds his humanity, remembers what it's like to be a good person. And there are so many moments in this movie where he literally is coming back to the fray, like Han Solo sweeping in the Falcon.
But that is the man with no name.
That's exactly the thing, is that we're not talking about different interpretations of Max. We're talking about two exemplars that borrow from the same source material, the monomyth and Joseph Campbell and the samurai culture. Like, there's so much that both Star Wars and George Miller are borrowing from that existed before either of them that feeds into how they write characters.
But I would argue that Max is definitely the man with no name. Like, he's just, that is everything he is from Road Warrior on. In Mad Max, he is a very different character.
Absolutely.
And in fact, it's so weird that Mad Max was the film, and that what became of that film makes Mad Max feel like a prequel, and makes Mad Max feel almost like an unworthy prequel. I mean, there's a lot of great stuff in Mad Max. I do not want to shit on Mad Max. It's a good fucking movie. But it's not the Road Warrior.
Yeah.
Like, the Road Warrior is perfection. And it's not even like, you can't even go Star Wars to Empire with that. Like, this is, a lot of people say that Aliens is the best sequel of all time. And I think in terms of being superior to your original, Road Warrior so trumps Mad Max in a way that no other sequel does.
See, and I'm surprised to hear you say that, because I thought for sure your answer to that question would have been Wrath of Khan.
Well, Wrath of Khan is different. Wrath of Khan plays by different rules. Like, yeah, technically Wrath of Khan is also so amazing and so great and so much better than its first movie. But its first movie, Star Trek the Motion Picture, doesn't stand on its own. It stands on 3 years of television. And it's you know, a movie based on a TV series that isn't an adaptation.
Which is crazy when
it's an extension.
Yes, which is crazy when you think about the fact that Wrath of Khan was intended to be a TV movie.
Yes.
That's fucking nuts to me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, The Killers was supposed to be a TV movie. Mm. I mean, that's something we brought up earlier. You know, The Killers was made for TV and by George Segal. And the network said, we can't put this on fucking TV. It's too violent.
Yeah.
And so George Segal said, well, let me take it up to the drive-in and see how it plays. And he played it. And it played like fucking gangbusters. And so they released it theatrically. And it became a theatrical fucking film. And then we got The Killers out of it. So that doesn't shock me. But The Road Warrior is head and shoulders above Mad Max in a way that I can't think of another film. I mean, yeah, Wrath of Khan. But I still would argue that Wrath of Khan has 3 great years of Star Trek to stand on to get there. Whereas Mad Max is literally the intro to the world, and then Road Warrior is just like, hi, Mad Max, I'm the movie everybody's going to watch.
You know what?
From
I will accept that, because in that regard, you absolutely cannot strip. It's called Wrath of Khan. It's a reference to a fucking episode of the show.
Yeah. In fact, I have a poster here in my house of that episode.
Yes. So in that way, absolutely, you could take the entire, and I kind of want to do this, actually. I think you can edit out the entire prologue of this movie and have never seen Mad Max, and this movie still fucking functions.
Oh, absolutely. But the thing is that's the only reason that's true is because we have come to accept post-apocalyptic as a legitimate thing. Up until this point, okay, so let's get a brief history of post-apocalyptic films, because this is actually an area of expertise.
Children, sit down. Grandpa Cargill has a story to tell.
There is a movie in the 30s.
Oh, I'm sorry. Not Grandpa Cargill.
Man Cargill, that old
we
man.
We don't need another Cargill.
Yeah, so there was a disaster movie in the 30s, and I'm blank. I want to say it's actually called Apocalypse, but it's not. That I've actually seen. It was a mostly lost and forgotten film that came out in the 30s, and it is a biblical disaster movie. And the disasters of the Bible happen, and it opens with the Bible verse, disasters of the Bible happen, and humanity is in a post-apocalypse. And it is, for a film made in the 30s, it is a rapey, fucking crazy movie in which this woman who is the protagonist ends up running across all these different groups of civilization and all these men that need women to reproduce. And it's terrifying. And it really created the genre that was ignored for a while. And then we hit a couple of stories, particularly Richard Matheson's I Am Legend.
Oh, yes.
Which is considered the seminal work of post-apocalyptic literature. If you've never read it, it's a breezy 200 pages. Highly recommend picking it up and reading it. You're like, oh, I've seen the movie, or I've seen all three iterations of the movie, in which you get The Last Man on Earth with Vincent Price, or Omega Man with
Charlton Heston,
or I Am Legend with Will Smith. None of them have the right ending, because the ending of that book is the whole point of that book. Are you?
Yeah, I think the movie you're referring to is called Deluge.
Deluge, yeah, yes. Deluge, yeah. It is Deluge. Deluge. And if you ever get a chance to check out Deluge, Deluge is a great post-apocalyptic movie. It is surprisingly good and harsh for its era. So we get I Am Legend, and we start getting the beginnings of post-apocalyptic. We get Harlan Ellison's great story of Boy and His Dog, in which he talks about humanity kind of sliding down and a post-apocalypse.
You get movies like Damnation Alley.
That stuff all comes from this, because yeah. Between Matheson and Ellison, they triggered a revolution in science fiction literature that took us to post-apocalyptic literature that led into post-apocalyptic television and film. By the time we get to 1982, we still don't have a solid language for post-apocalypse. And so George Miller and the studio feels there needs to be an explanation. We need to lay out why this happened, how it happened, and we need to explain it. Once this movie happens, it was, if you will, an atomic bomb in the landscape of post-apocalyptic fiction, and audiences just accepted that it happened. And we might find out why it happened and we might not, but that doesn't matter, because right. These are essentially futuristic Westerns, and that's what it is. And that's the point to it. And we believe it in the same way that we believe that the Old West was as violent as Westerns portray it, even though it really fucking wasn't.
Right.
So this is, he created the language that we then followed, and he did it by borrowing from a number of greats, but it got him up to this point to where once that movie was made, you never needed an explanation. So now you could take that explanation out. But I would argue that in 1982, you couldn't, because audiences would be like, what is this? And even in like one of our favorites, 1981's Battle Truck.
Yeah.
Battle Truck. It's, you know, it opens with, you know, in the 21st century, the oil wars, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, all right, we get it. That's what it was. That's what broke down. And it made all of this. Also, keep in mind, we haven't mentioned this. The historical context of why this movie exists is entirely because of the oil crisis in the 70s, because people had a point where they had to, you could only go to gas stations on certain days depending on what number was on your fucking license plate.
Yeah, I mean, the gas shortage coupled with the looming threat of nuclear war of the Cold War.
Yep.
Like, those two things together.
Married.
Yeah, that gives us.
And once you explain it, yeah. And explain it as vague as Miller does, where the two great tribes went to war. Like, he doesn't actually, he's like, I don't need the politics of this. You just need to know.
We all know that when two tribes go to war, guzzoline is all that you can score.
Guzzoline is all you can score. So it is the language was then from that point on, nobody really needed it. Like, if I sat down and wrote a post-apocalyptic movie today, nobody would be like, what ended the earth? In fact, sometimes when post-apocalyptic films explain the ending, that's where they get it wrong. Like, there's this, God, I'm trying to think of the name of it. About a decade ago, there was this great series of midnight movies that would be put out as a film festival. It was called Eight to Die For. It went for 3 years, and they picked up all of these. It was before VOD was really a thing. So they would pick up these genre favorites. And they, in a, for a weekend, your local cinema would show each of the 8 films, and then they'd put them out as a box set. And one of the films they had was this really cool post-apocalyptic film that just fell apart when you tugged at, we just ran out of gas, and so the world fell to shit. And so now this group of people is wandering around in kind of a littered wasteland, dealing with their own shit. And it feels more like a zombie apocalypse movie, even though it's post-apocalyptic. And it's like, wait, we forgot how to make steam engines?
Right.
Like, yeah. Really? We lost all that technology?
See, I have a retort to that, in that I feel like, especially when you're talking about Australia, I think they were just waiting for a fucking excuse to go into, like, wasteland warrior mode. Like, these guys had these outfits ready to go, and it's like, oh, we're out of gas? All right, I guess it's the end times now, and I'm the warlord of the wasteland.
I am the Ayatollah of rock and roller.
Break the wall! Break down the walls!
Once again, you have made me unleash my dogs of war.
Like, oh my god, I love Humongous. Humongous is a great fucking villain.
Remember that time that Nick Robb created a Humongous account on Twitter?
I do remember that. Ask Film Twitter. That was fucking amazing. By the way, I think I have been to the greatest screening of all time of The Road Warrior. It wasn't, unfortunately, one with George Miller at South by Southwest. It was one at a racetrack where the screening was preceded by a demolition derby, and then a metal band did a cover of We Don't Need Another Hero, and there's literally... So, demolition derbies are dangerous enough, right?
Yes.
They decided to put these big oil drums all over the track and fill them with gasoline and fire so that anytime a car hit one, it would explode. And I'm sitting there with a giant can of Foster's watching this mayhem unfold, and then an inflatable screen pops up in the middle of the track. We watch the Road Warrior, and then this band starts playing, "We don't need another hero."
I feel like the only way that could be better is if it were Four Loko and not Foster's.
This is true, but I will say it
was Brian Four Loko hands.
Brian Four Loko hands. Ask Film Twitter. It was made all the better because it was the Alamo Summer of 82 series, and it was the screening that was sponsored by FilmSchoolRejects.com. .apocalypse. And yeah, I was like, I am proud that the website I work for is associated with this nightmare.
I heard about that screening and I didn't make it, and I totally regret everything.
It was fucking amazing. I was like, this is I feel like this is never what George Miller intended, but he would have appreciated for sure.
I don't know. He kind of made a movie in which a guy plays a guitar on a flaming truck.
The Doof Warrior is everything to me.
We will at some point cover Fury Road. Fury Road will get covered at some point.
As an amuse-bouche to that episode, can we talk about the fact that there is a theory as to who Tom Hardy's character is in that film and how it directly relates to the Road Warrior? Because we get to the end of the Road Warrior, and I think one of the greatest switcheroos in cinema happens in this movie, where, and spoilers for the Road Warrior if you haven't seen it. Now that we're just joined by people who have seen it, the fact that Humongous's cronies are chasing this fucking tanker full of gasoline, and it wrecks, and we find out that it's full of sand, and they've pulled like a Danny Ocean shenanigan to sneak the real oil out. I think it's fucking marvelous. Also, by the way, the main crony in this movie, I didn't recognize him for many, many viewings. I believe the character's name is Wes. He's the one who keeps a slave, and then is the dog of war that's unleashed at the end.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's played by the actor Vernon Wells, who also plays Bennett in Commando.
Oh,
as
yes.
In Let Off Some Steam, Bennett.
Yes.
That's fucking rad. I love that. I love that connection. He's also in Innerspace. He's in Weird Science. He's in Space Truckers. I mean, really, a lot of movies that we could potentially talk about on Junk Food Cinema. But yeah, so all of that happens. And then at the end of the movie, we find out that the narrator of the entire film was the Feral Kid, just running around with that hockey mullet and a boomerang and being awesome in this film. It turns out the narrator, he's like, and eventually I grew up and became the leader of the Great Northern Tribe. There is a theory that the character that Tom Hardy is playing in Fury Road is the slightly more grown-up version of the Feral Kid from The Road Warrior before he ascends to becoming the leader of the Great Northern Tribe.
That theory is wrong.
Do you think so?
I think it is.
You don't think there's any credence to that whatsoever?
No, there's not, because the one part of Fury Road that really ties... So here's my issue with Fury Road. My issue with Fury Road, my one issue, is I wish it weren't Max. I wish it were somebody else. Because if it were anybody else, if his name were just Tom, what we would not know what he would do when he goes off to kill those guys and then comes back to the tanker. The fact that he comes back is a big deal. When we know he's Max and he's the Max we've watched, we know he's coming back. We know who that Max is. He's not Han Solo in Star Wars anymore. He's Han Solo in Return of the Jedi. This Han Solo is not going to let us down. Like, he's just not. He's Han Solo. He's going to come through. And at that point, we know he's going to come through, and I wish he were someone else. But he has flashbacks to the kids in Thunderdome, and that's happening all throughout this movie, where he's having these flashbacks to the whole Thunderdome thing, which is what ties it in to that Max, and he feels guilty for the things that happened in Thunderdome, and he's still living with that and can't live with himself. And that is, again, part of the movie I wish didn't happen, because yeah, I would love it if it were the feral kid.
No, and I think that what you just mentioned, the flashbacks to, that's the smoking gun. The Max thing, I feel like the fact that
he could have taken the name. Yeah,
he was a feral kid. He didn't have a fucking name.
He didn't have a name.
All he talks about at the end of Road Warrior is, I knew him as Max.
But the flashbacks are the smoking gun.
Yeah, fuck. That's disappointing.
Because I would love that. I would love if Mad Max Fury Road, it turns out we get a moment where he, you know, shit gets down and he pulls out a boomerang and chucks a boomerang at someone, and then later tells a story you know, yeah, where he's like, he's like, well, my name isn't really Max. You know, I just call myself Max because a guy who was my hero once and taught me how to be a man. Was named Max.
Yeah, they only have one remaining vehicle to get them away from the Morton Joe, and it's not a car; it's an old gyrocopter that he's been keeping in a cave for 30 years. Oh my! Okay, guys, we gotta go rewrite a few things about Fury Road, a mostly perfect movie that I feel like
I think it's a perfect movie. I personally, that's my personal hangup. I feel this film would have been stronger if it wasn't Max, but it is Max, and it's a great fucking movie. And
to be fair, we are big fans of headcanon, so that may be our bias toward everything needs to be connected.
Also true.
Because we're kind of guys that think everything should be connected, and we're disappointed when it's not. Speaking of great sequels, by the way, this movie, among many other filmmakers, was a huge influence on James Cameron, where do you fall in the Terminator 2 debate, by the way? Because I've heard a lot of people kind of retroactively going back and thinking that it's not great anymore.
They're full of shit.
Okay, cool.
Terminator 2 is Terminator 2. Like, I mean,
the end of argument.
We have a very good friend in common, Romeo, who is very wrong about Terminator 2 and always has been and always will be.
Well, he's not the only one. I've heard several people in Go Ask Film Twitter who have kind of looked back in retrospect and said a lot of unkind things about Terminator 2, about how it doesn't hold up, and I Mad Max furiously disagree. I think it is an absolutely stellar sequel and has aged beautifully. I think some of the effects in that movie are better than things I see now in blockbuster movies, so I am firmly in that camp as well. I was just curious where you landed on that. But yeah, I mean, this is a movie, I mean, it breathes diesel and spits fire and is so dangerous and so, like, even little things. Like, there's a shot where Max is lying across the gyrocopter and he's flying over the compound, and it's really Mel Gibson, like, on a board hanging out of a helicopter. They wouldn't fucking do that today.
No.
There's no way that, like, even if they had current day Mel Gibson and they weren't that afraid of losing him, they would still not fucking do that.
Yeah, it's like, wait, we gotta drop the racist guy? Maybe.
Man, that whole line about living long enough to seeing yourself become the villain is watching Road Warrior and then knowing what Mel Gibson is today. That's depressing. That's why that's the real reason I wish that the headcanon existed in Fury Road and we could just imagine it was always Tom Hardy somehow.
It's Feral Kid.
Just pass the mantle to Feral Kid and everything will be fine. But yeah, I fucking love it. This is a very important movie to me, to us, to this podcast. I mean, it's the granddaddy of an entire movement of cinema that inspired our drunken conversations, that inspired this podcast. Like, it is a landmark film. It is a genius film. And all the while we're talking about the stunt work, there is great character development. There are epic storylines at work. There's monomyth at play. Like, there is so much brilliance in this film that I think, like, maybe not a lot of people, but I feel like there's a faction of people that don't fully appreciate this film, and I think that's wrong. I think this is the kind of movie that is one of the best.
This is its action as cinema.
Yes.
Like, it is undeniably cinema. And that's what's brilliant about what George Miller does with these movies is, like, I would argue that Mad Max is a movie. I would argue that this is cinema. I would argue that Fury Road is cinema.
I would agree with that 1,000%. And even Ebert says that this goes on a list with Bullet, The French Connection, and The Truck Chase in Raiders of the Lost Ark as among the great chase films of modern years. And I could not agree with that more. And that brings us to the junk food pairing. Cargill, I got nothing. I was so entranced by all of the explosions and all of the wrecks and all of the stuntmen flipping here and there that I was at a little bit of a loss with this one, because you can't actually drink guzzoline. I know this because I drank Four Loko and it's damn close.
I was recently at a book festival in Tucson, Arizona. And while we were there, I was invited out with... Oh, wait, no. I take that back. It was not there. I was in Colorado. I was at the Colorado Comic-Con. And I was invited out with a bunch of writers who are very... They're foodies, and they're experimental foodies. And they had a place that served all sorts of game. And they were like... This serves venison. They serve, you know, all sorts of crazy stuff. I, while I was there, feasted on yak, which, by the way, Whoa. Is fucking delicious.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
If you ever get it, yak is expensive and it is fucking delicious. It is melt in your mouth beef. It is amazing. However, that's not what I am going to talk about. My recommendation is rattlesnake queso. They made a rattlesnake queso that was fucking delicious. That was exactly what it sounds like. And if ever there was a junk food to pair perfectly with Mad Max, I feel like rattlesnake queso is it.
Yeah.
It is what this movie is. It is punk rock as fuck. It is delicious. It is tasty. And there are no complaints. It's a bunch of things you, I swear to God, I saw the look on your face, never thought to put in combination together. But once you did, now it makes nothing but sense.
Well, it's one of those rare instances where it's like, no, I've actually had rattlesnake in my life, and there's not a lot of meat there, so it would take a shit ton of rattlesnake to actually make that queso, but I'm down to try that 1,000%.
Well, it's queso with rattlesnake sprinkled over it that you get in with the chips. It's not, that's the beauty of queso, is it doesn't take a lot of meat to fill the queso with meat. So it really stretches out the rattlesnake, but it is fucking fabu.
So whereas a place like Magnolia has a cowboy queso that's chorizo or brisket.
Yes.
This would be a road warrior queso that has rattlesnake. I like this. I like this very much. I'm going to have to try it. Guys, thank you so much for joining us on this this savage exploration of the darker parts of the post-apocalyptic wasteland that is the Road Warrior. I am never going to not love gushing about post-apocalyptic movies on this show. It's kind of our wheelhouse, and I love being there. But if you want to hear more of us gushing about movies, you can find our entire back catalog on iTunes, on Spotify, on Blog Talk Radio. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. And if you really like the show...
I mean really like the show.
If you like the show more than I am desperate to try me some rattlesnake queso, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. And for as little as a dollar an episode, you get access to bonus content that no one else gets to hear. Cargill, where can people find you in the wastelands of the internet?
Well, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Massaworm, MASSAWYRM. You can find my book, in part inspired by the Road Warrior, called Sea of Rust, on Audible, anywhere you buy your books. Nominated for the Arthur C. Clarke Award for Science Fiction Literature. I am proud as hell of it. So if you enjoy The Road Warrior, why not read The Road Warrior with robots? So that's a thing you can do. Also, you can check out my new podcast on writing called Write Along, available at writealongpodcast.com.
Nice. And I'm going to, you can find me at Bry Guy Salisbury, and of course at Junk Food Cinema on Twitter. And I'm going to close this out by just reminding you that in the future, cities will become deserts, roads will become battlefields, and the hope of mankind will appear as a Jim's Diner sign in the night. Yeah.